This podcast of The Magic Word is brought to you by East Coast Mind Jam, happening in Somerset, New Jersey on March 28th through 30th. This one-time-only event will be featuring Mark Salem, Richard Osterlin, Ted Karmilowicz, Banachek, Doc Hilford, and Devin Knight. It will also be honoring Tony Spina. So be sure to visit eastcoastmindjam.com for more information and register today. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast, broadcasting to you today from South Lake Tahoe. And today my guest is Alex Ramone. Hey there, Alex.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing fantastic. So glad to have you.
Thank you for having me on the podcast, because it's been a little while since the last time we spoke, and so I think it's going to be fun, too.
Well, this is kind of a makeup. You know, we tried to get together, and our friend Larry Clark,
right,
who was he the lead clown for Ringling Brothers?
He was the clown and the pre-show host of Ringling Brothers Circus that I was the ringmaster of.
Right.
And so, yeah, Larry and I toured for 2 years together. Great guy, great clown.
Yeah. And he came over to the house, and we were going to do a podcast. And we did this back when I was still working with Dodd Vickers on the
right.
Magic Newswire, and I know that you kind of had a little window and didn't get together, and I thought, I'm going to get with Alex sometime.
Yeah, we got to do it, and I'm glad we were able to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, there's so much to talk about, but I think that chronologically might be a good way of starting, and so I think this is important, particularly for youth or those who might be interested in entering contests. Now, you're from the San Francisco, the Bay Area,
right?
And so you got involved with magic at a very early age, but really started getting involved with contests, and I find that kind of fascinating. You're about 16 or so when you started
You know, when I was a kid, I never saw a magic show. I never wanted to become a magician. That was never a goal of mine. I didn't I really was kind of new to this world of magic that we know.
Yeah.
And it became a hobby of mine.
Did you join the clubs? I mean, a little bit?
I didn't have clubs. I didn't know about SAM. I didn't know about IBM.
Right.
I didn't know what the Magic Castle was. Mm-hmm. I had never seen a David Copperfield special. I never saw anything. I really had no idea.
So you weren't influenced by anybody?
Nobody.
Like, you weren't going to be a Lance Burton clone, obviously.
No, because I didn't know who
he
was.
Sure.
So basically, I think that was a good thing for me. But anyhow, what ended up happening is a friend of my dad showed me a magic trick, a card trick. I was amazed. I went to a magic shop in San Francisco called Misdirections Magic Shop, which is a fantastic magic shop.
Still there?
Brick and mortar. There.
Wow.
And, I mean, he is great. Joe Pond is the owner. Great, close friend of mine. He has known me since I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, after being there for a while and frequenting his shop, I did join his club, and he would have lectures every month. He would have a lecture. And then what ended up happening is he produced a magic contest every year.
Uh-huh.
And he did this San Francisco magic contest. And he said, you know, you should really do it. And at the time, I didn't really want to perform. It was my hobby. And so when I was first beginning 13, 14, and 15 years old, I wasn't doing shows. And my mom said, hey, you got to do some magic shows. And it really didn't – it wasn't a goal of mine to perform. It was my hobby. I wanted it to be my secret. Nobody knew about it because magic to me was a secret. I didn't want anybody else to know about it. I didn't want any of my friends to know about it because then they would know. They
so
would
you didn't
want
show
to get,
your friends?
No.
Well, that's interesting.
And then they
could –
well, because then they would want to –
be like you or learn magic
also. Yeah, to get a magic book and a video, and then they would learn it.
Right.
And then I'm like, well, what? They shouldn't know this. You know, they shouldn't be doing this.
Right.
So it's kind of my little secret.
That's
but then – what ended up inevitably happening is I did start to performing, and which led to the contests.
And where did you start to perform? I mean, what kind of venues as a teenager were you working?
Well,
birthday
first,
parties, I assume.
Of course, birthday parties. My mom was a teacher, so I did shows at her kindergarten class and the preschool and things like this. Of course, church groups and things like that. And then I started working at a restaurant doing close-up magic. At a Chevy's restaurant in Richmond. And then,
which is a Tex-Mex restaurant for those
Tex-Mex,
of you overseas who are listening to this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was a Tex-Mex restaurant, and I would do close-up just for tips. I never got paid.
Oh, really? Just busking?
Just tips. I never solicited tips. I just had a pin that said tips appreciated, and that was it.
Were you paid by the venue also? I mean,
no.
Chevy's did not pay me.
They gave me free meals, which to be honest, is a really good deal.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what it was. But I did go. Then I ended up going to those contests, and I got more into stage type magic than close up. And I still do close up, but that kind of was led me on that path.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ended up winning a couple, and eventually led to me going to the World Magic Seminar in Las Vegas and winning the Lance Burton Award when I was 18.
Yeah.
And in doing that, as I recall, that you had to be vetted. I mean, they had videos, tapes of everybody or whatever. And then if you were a certain caliber, then they would let you.
Absolutely.
Because they only had like 10 or 12 people. Because they had a lot of people back then who were really wanting to compete.
Absolutely. I think there was 11 competitors the year that I won. And there was a screening process. You had to send a video of your act. Mm-hmm. And then they would be reviewed. And then you would get a letter saying where you were accepted to compete. Mm-hmm. And my year, there was 11 competitors. That I won. And so, and that kind of led me on the path and, and at that point, then I had been, now that I was 18, I had been performing. And I mean, I was really blessed early on, especially in my teenage years. And it's funny because I just preceded this by saying that I didn't want to perform. But once I began performing, I had really good success. Newspaper, it was really weird. All of a sudden, a reporter or journalist would call me and leave a message on the phone. Mm-hmm. Hey, I heard about you. I want to do a story on you. And then I was on the front page of newspapers, and I was getting all this publicity for free just by performing. And people would ask me to perform for this and that, and I always said yes. So every show led to another show, another opportunity. So by the time I won Lance Burton Award and my senior year in high school, I was a senior in high school performing over 250 shows a year.
Wow.
And
senior in high school.
And a senior in high school.
Oh my gosh.
And so I was performing. At that time, I did a lot of libraries. So when I was 16, 17, I did this library showcase in the Bay Area where all these librarians from different counties and cities would come and watch talent, and I went out there and I performed. I did some magic. And
did you see yourself as a children's entertainer more than an adult?
No, absolutely not.
Really?
I never here's the funny thing is I never did any apparatus type magic. My whole show in teenager was all manipulative.
Manipulation,
because, because I didn't want to do hippity hop rabbits. I didn't want to do stratosphere. I didn't want to do vanishing ketchup bottle or
standard
the dye box. Mm-hmm. Not that those are bad tricks, but to be honest, I've never even seen them. I've never seen stratosphere performed. I've never seen hippity hop rabbits performed. Yeah. I've never seen any of those things.
But you're aware of those.
I'm aware of them.
How do you know about them?
Well, I'm aware of them now because I know what they're called.
Okay.
But I actually have never even seen them done.
Okay.
And you know, traditionally, when you think children's entertainer, you have apparatus, you have props.
Sure.
And my my children's show was, I did my dove act in people's homes.
Really?
I'd produce four birds. Huh. I'd use flash string and flash paper and confetti and throw streamers. I did card manipulation. I did Miser's Dream. I did billiard ball manipulation. I did linking rings.
Yeah.
It was all manipulative.
How'd that go over
magic
with kids? I mean, I don't see that as a children's.
Exactly.
But they dug it?
They did. And I think the reason is because whenever you get a children's entertainer, children's magician, they wouldn't be doing that stuff.
Right. You know, that's because, you know, David Gannon, you know, all the guys that talk about
children's
magic, there are all kinds of props and flashy colors and all kinds of things.
Even Silly Billy has a lot of – Silly Billy has some apparatus stuff out that and it's great stuff.
Right.
But at that time – and even, you know, sometimes people would ask me, oh, do you package – do you do balloon animals and do you party favors and party bags and you can upsell and
– Exactly, back of the room.
Back of the room and, you know, upsell these party bags for $10 extra and you provide all. I was under the impression that at this point I was like, I'm a magician and I do magic.
They're paying me to do magic.
Exactly.
Not as a salesman.
And so, and to be honest, when I began, people would say when they wanted to do a show at that time, even whether it was a library, whether it was a birthday party, they'd say, okay, well, you know, this magician was calling, you know, he said he'll do 45 minutes or an hour with balloon animals and it's the same price as you. And I said, well, you can do that. I said, but I do. And I'm as a teenager saying this, I go, I do 35 to 40 minutes. It's magic, and that's it. If you want that guy, you want the party favors and the balloons, go ahead. That's fine.
Yeah.
But I do a magic show for 40 minutes, and I just stuck to my guns. I kind of said, this is what I do. I don't do balloons. I'm a magician, and I do magic. And and to be honest, most of the people calling me to hire me weren't price checking.
Yeah.
They were calling to hire me, not to try and get just a magician.
You think it's
because I didn't advertise.
They had seen you in the magazines and newspapers and whatever kind of promotional thing that you didn't really – it sounds like you had a business plan without actually having a plan.
Absolutely.
It just happened.
It happened organically and naturally, and I was very blessed. I only had business cards. I never took out ads. I was never in – I never did any advertising.
Word of mouth.
It was 100% word of mouth. And my current business today still – is word of mouth. And yeah. I'm sure as, you know, we go on in this this interview chronologically, we'll get to that and what I mean by that.
Yeah. Well, so then you did win the big award with Lance Burton.
Yep.
And then you returned back to the Bay Area. Then you were 18. And it was going to be a little bit of time before you came back to interview in Vegas for,
exactly.
for the Disney thing. But what happened during that period?
So when I got off tour you confused me. When I got back from the World Magic Seminar, when I was there, I met a man named Steve Daly, who is a fantastic, fantastic person, one of the sweetest people I know in my life. Mm-hmm. And out of, I would say there have been three people who have really aided me in my career. And Steve Daly was the first.
He knows really how to do it. He knows he has a good eye, you know, for molding, particularly a young person, I think, to being, and he pushes them in being contests.
Absolutely.
He really does encourage that kind of thing. And that
if anybody does not know who Steve Daly is, they need to know who he is.
Definitely.
And they need to befriend him.
Yep.
And I still call him to this day and ask for advice. And he's the sweetest man
in
the world.
Did you know that he also, as an aside, paints these you know, like circus, not circus posters, but kind of like, I guess you have seen him in circus posters that are kind of like, you know, the rubber man and the bearded woman. That
yeah.
Kind of thing. He's incredible.
And he
can do
actually,
anything.
He makes his own props. He makes set pieces. He designs, I mean, he does costumes. I mean, he does everything.
Yeah.
So he
does a hip act.
He does a hip
act. Bonnie the Bitch.
Yeah.
That is so funny. I saw him do that in Houston. When he went, oh, God.
Yeah.
Great guy.
He's great. So I met Steve Daly after I won the Lance Burton Award. And he said, oh, congratulations. Where are you from? I said, oh, I'm from San Francisco. And he said, San Francisco Bay Area. And he said, well, you know what? Let's keep in touch. I might have an opportunity for you in San Francisco. And I said, okay. And I went back to San Francisco and I started working in a show called Circus Cabaret. And it was a variety show with circus acts on Broadway in San Francisco. And I began doing this variety show, and I did my Dove act with card manipulation. And and I did, you know, it was like an 8 or 9 minute act, and I was part of this show. And I began doing that regularly on top of doing other performances. And then Steve had gave me a call, and we spoke, and he said, you know, David Sachs is going to be opening V on Pier 39 in San Francisco. I told him about you. We need a local Dove act, and I think it'd be great. Would you be interested? I said, absolutely. I got a contract offer for 6 months, six nights a week, two shows a night. Unfortunately, the deal never really happened. You know, David Sachs and some people from Vegas, from the Ultimate Variety Show, V, came from Vegas and did like one night or two shows. And then it kind of, and it closed. I mean, it kind of just didn't work out. I don't know all the details. You know what? I don't know all the details of it. But I just know it didn't really come into fruition.
Too bad.
It was too bad. But you know what? I was excited because I at least had a contract offer, and it didn't happen, but I was offered, and I was at least being talked about.
Yeah.
And I was about 18 or 19 at this point. And I started working these variety shows in San Francisco. And then when I was 20 years old, I did that for a couple years. And when I was 20 years old, I got a call from Steve Daly again. He left me a voicemail. And then he said, hey, call me back, Alex. I want to talk to you about something. And then he called me again. He left two voicemails. And it was late by the time I got these voicemails. And I thought, I'm going to call him tomorrow. And he called me a third time that night because I was like, I'm going to call him tomorrow. And,
he's like, hey.
Yeah. And he's like, hey, Alex, it's Steve. And I go, oh, Steve, I got your voicemails. So I was going to call you tomorrow. He goes, no. He goes, I need to talk to you tonight. And he said, Alex, I just found out about, there's a Disney magic show that is being produced, and it's going to, you know, it's going to happen, and they're looking for young magicians to tour with this production show. It's with Kenneth Feld Entertainment, who at the time, I didn't know who he was.
Producing Siegfried and Roy.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, I would say again, I was a little naive in the magic world. I just, again, I'd never seen magicians. Yep. I started doing a magic show before I had even seen a magic show.
Yeah.
And I never saw any magic on, I saw World's Greatest Magic a little bit, but I didn't know anybody on that. And I never saw, like I said, a Copperfield special or anything. So he says, Kenneth Feld. And I said, okay, I don't know who that is. And he goes, you will. And I said, okay. And he
goes, boy, will you?
Yeah. He says,
in the future.
Yeah. He says, call this man. He's expecting your call tomorrow and he's going to set you up with an audition. And I said, okay. And I Googled Kenneth Feld, and I was like, oh.
Wow.
Yeah. And I said,
it's a real deal.
Yeah. I was like, okay. So the next day I called this man. He said, okay, let's set you up with an interview, with an audition. He set me up with an audition. And this goes back to what I had said before when people were price checking me. And I guess this has been my my attitude my whole career. You know, I kind of was like, well, if I can go to the audition, I'll see if I can make it. I wasn't like, oh man, I have to go. I'm ready. I was like, I'm doing my thing, and if it works out, then I'll go. And I know he was like, well, you really need to go on this audition. Like, you, this is huge. And I was like, if it works in my schedule, I'll try and do it. And I go, I'm really busy because the audition was going to happen around Christmas time. It was in between Christmas Day and New Year's. Mm-hmm. And he said the audition was going to be in Las Vegas. And can I think it was like December 28th. For some reason, that day stands out in my mind. And they said, can you make that audition? I said, I don't know. I have a lot of shows booked. I mean, just let me know when we get the date and the time, and I'll see if I can go out to Vegas and do it.
Right.
And I was 20. So what ended up happening is I set up the date, and this is the absolute truth. It's amazing how this worked. Mm-hmm. I had prayed about this situation, and I said, well, you know, if I'm really meant to do this, I want all the doors to open. I don't want to jump through hoops. I want the doors to open for me to do this audition. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to try and aggressively get this job or go audition for this Disney show. And what ended up happening is I said, okay, so it's set for like the 28th. One of my good friends from high school called me up and said, hey, Alex, my 21st birthday is coming up, and one of my other friends can't go to my birthday party. I'm going to bring everybody to Vegas. I know you're not 21 yet.
Wow.
Yeah. Because I was
serendipitous.
Exactly. All his friends that he had invited were over 21. He didn't invite me because I wasn't 21.
Sure.
So he goes, I know you're only, I mean, I didn't invite you because you're not 21 yet. So you can't go to anything, but one of my other friends can't go and I have an extra plane ticket. Do you want to go to Vegas? I go, when is it? He goes, December 28th and 29th and we'll be back. And I was like, yeah, I have an audition there. I'll go. And immediately when I got the phone with Dominic, I was like, I think I got this in my head.
Yeah.
Because he literally, after I got the phone, said, well, maybe if it works out. An hour later, Dominic called me and said, I have a free flight to Vegas.
Yeah.
And there
it's
you
like,
go.
Yep.
I went to
Stars
Vegas.
Stars are aligning. You could see it.
Absolutely. I went to Vegas. I went on the audition. In the audition, the choreographer was there and they're videotaping me to send to the director. And he said, you know, we want to see your personality and how you, you know, engage and can you do these things? And I said, you know, I don't do that. And he's like, and this is in the audition.
Yeah.
And this is my recording video sending to the director. And I said, I don't do that. And he goes, okay, what do you mean? I go, I do magic silently to music, like manipulation, like what I do in the birthday parties, or I do something audience participation.
Right.
And it's just me and you. He goes, okay. I said, so I don't do stand up magic and talk. I don't do that.
Okay.
And I'm saying this in the audition, and I'm thinking, okay, that's right. You know, the first thing he asked me to do, I say, no, I don't do that.
But it felt right to you.
But it felt right to me because
you're honest.
I look at, I'm going to say, look, this is what I do. And I think that's very important for magicians and for people to realize that, you know, when you lie or you try and say something and try and, you know, you go after something that you're actually not, you're actually hurting yourself if you are saying you can do something and you can't. Because one day is going to happen where you're going to have to deliver. And if you can't deliver, that'll ruin you forever.
Yeah.
So I would rather say, this is what I do and I can deliver doing this. And if you ask me to do this, well, now I'm not the right guy for you.
Yeah.
And what ends up happening is I did the audition and a couple weeks later they called me and said, hey, want you to fly out and join the show. And that's what I did. So I began touring with Disney when I was 20. I did 3 years with them. I did a domestic tour in the United States in 2006, and I did 2 years overseas in 2007-2008.
And when you're saying touring, let me talk about that for a moment, that this was like in convention centers and amphitheaters and
places? No, this is our major theaters in America and across the world, really. I mean, one of the theaters we performed at was the Kodak Theater in Hollywood. So the Kodak Theater was the home of the Oscars.
Right.
And this is where American Idol was being filmed. So we're talking, you know, major theaters. It's not just the performing arts centers. They are major theaters, some Broadway houses across the country. I mean, we performed at...
And you were part of a variety act then, so you just did like, what, a 12-minute
show? No. And this, so the Disney show was really amazing. It's the first of its kind where it had real people, I have to be careful now saying this, with the Disney characters.
Okay.
So I, myself and another magician named Brad Ross were hired to be on this show. So there's two magicians in the show when we opened. And we were in the show performing magic and illusions. And this is also where I met Jim Steinmeier for the first, well, basically where our relationship
began. And he was hired by Disney, I assume.
He was hired by Kenneth Feld to be the illusion and magic consultant for the Disney Live Mickey's Magic Show, is what it's called. And so we went there, and it was a play with the Disney characters with a themed around magic. So, and it wasn't just Disney magic, quote unquote. It was actual illusion magic.
So it wasn't like Mickey Mouse as a Sorcerer's Apprentice.
No, it was Mickey Mouse as a magician with two magicians. And the storyline was basically, I was a bumbling character type magician. And then Brad was kind of like a big brother to me in a way. And he kind of was encouraging me, and Mickey Mouse was encouraging me, saying, hey, believe in yourself, believe in yourself.
Yeah.
And in the end, I can do that. And during the show, there's a lot of fun moments with the Disney characters and magic. And we did a levitation, and there was a black art number, and there was a twister, and there, Brad and I did a double sawing. And I mean, there was a lot of illusions in the show. But that was the premise of the show. And here's one other thing, and it goes back to, again, how I've always been, is in rehearsals. When I was originally hired, they wanted me to be more of a villainous character. And I was kind of more of this darker type character. And then when I got to the audition, or when I got to the rehearsals, they said, oh, we changed it a little bit. You're going to be more like this bumbling character. We're going to put you like in glasses and kind of make it like nerdy character.
Sure.
And I said, well, okay, I don't really get it. And about 2 weeks into rehearsals, and we didn't do any magic the first 2 weeks. It was blocking, and we got a script. Yeah. We had to learn lines, and we didn't do any magic. And I'm kind of like, well, I'm a magician. I'm not an actor. I don't do a play. Yeah. And I'm kind of doing a play. Mm-hmm. And we hadn't gone to any of the magic yet. And I went and I told the director, Jerry Billick, who is, I mean, I have so much respect for this guy, and really is the one who hired me and kept me on Disney. Basically, I said, I think you got the wrong guy. I said, I don't think I'm right for this show. And I was being honest again. Yeah, it was me saying, I think you need a recast.
Yeah, you're putting me into something that's not me, and it's not comfortable.
It's not comfortable to me, and I want to do a good job.
Yeah.
And I think
I look like I'm acting. And
exactly. Yeah. And Jerry ended up saying, you know what, Alex, you just please believe me on this. You're doing fine. Just let's get through this. And I kind of agreed to him, agreed with him, and said, okay. And that's what we did. So basically, I toured with them for 3 years, and I absolutely loved it. And here's one other thing is, at the end of the first year, we ended in Mexico, and then I flew home, and we were going to fly. The show, Disney Live, was going to open in Japan in just a couple months. And I flew home, and I had a conference call with Jerry Billick again. And I was ready to say, you know, I don't think I'm going to do the second year. I did the first year. I'm glad I did it. It was great, but I just
was it a one-year contract? And then
it was a one-year with a one-year option.
Extended, okay.
Uh-huh. And so I said I was basically saying that I wasn't going to do that second year option. And I told Jerry Billick that, and he said to me, and this is the first time I ever heard anything about Ringling Brothers Circus, is Jerry said to me on the phone, he goes, Alex, I've talked to Kenneth. Kenneth said he has plans for you. Just
because he'd seen the show and already.
Oh yeah. Of course. I mean, all the while Kenneth Feld and his daughter, Nicole Feld, knew me and they were obviously producing the show. And they were, so I knew them, as the producers, and they
were
saw
they touring
us
with the show? I mean, they
oh
got
no,
so
absolutely
much,
not.
I would, okay,
yeah. I mean, the Felds have their
so many
Kenneth,
fingers
yeah,
and so many pies.
Yeah, Kenneth at the time has his headquarters, his main offices were in Vienna, Virginia, and so that's where he was.
I did
all
not
the
know
time.
That.
Yeah, but they would come out and see the show, and they saw the show in the Kodak Theater, and then when we opened in DC, and all these other places, and we did do a 2 week run in Disney World in Orlando, which was a lot of fun. But yeah, so I mean, here we come off this our first year with Disney, and then we did. I told Jerry Billick, I don't think I'm going to do the second year, and he said, I talked to Kenneth. Kenneth said, hey, look, there's light at the end of this tunnel. Just let's keep going. Because all the while, this is something that's interesting, is that the Disney company, was trying to take Brad and I slowly out of the show because we were getting a little bit more credit, and people were clapping for us a little bit more than Mickey Mouse. So they pulled, and throughout this tour, I was getting pulled out, and Brad was getting pulled out of the show more and more.
They wanted it to be
more Disney,
generic, and more Disney.
More Disney.
You're right.
I mean, that's no fault of theirs. That's their brand, and they should be looking out for that.
Right.
It just changed, the show from its original content. Yeah. But then Jerry said, don't worry, he has plans for you. And I said to Jerry Billick, I said, on your word that Kenneth has plans, I'll do the second year. Okay. I did the second year. And a few months, you know, maybe like 8 or 9 months later, I was approached by Nicole Feld and Kenneth, and they said, we want to do a magic-themed Ringling Brothers Circus, and we want you to do it. Mm-hmm. And that led me to my next adventure, and probably the biggest and greatest adventure that I've been on yet.
And I just and that was a Zing Zang Zoom?
Zing Zang Zoom.
Tell me about that.
Well, they approached me, and they asked me to be a part of that show. And
You didn't know what you were going to be doing.
Whenever he said
to begin with it, we have plans for you. And when they came to you and then they said, we want you to be like the ringmaster for a circus,
here's the other thing is that they didn't know in what capacity. They just knew they wanted to do a magic-themed circus and they wanted me to be the magician.
Okay.
And that's all they knew.
And what did you think at the time?
This is what I said to them. I said, I'm interested. I've never seen a circus.
You are one unusual dude.
I know. I mean, I had never seen a circus.
My first job was with a circus.
Really?
I was 8 years old.
What did you do?
I was 8 years old, and my dad took me to a circus, the Big Top. I mean, talking about back in the 50s or whatever, you know. And when it came to town, after the circus was over, they said that we're looking for, you know, strong men to be roustabouts, basically take down the tents, and we'll work with the elephants to pull the stakes out and all this kind of stuff. And so I said, Dad, can I do that? And he said, okay. So he kind of stood by and watched. Well, obviously, I was too small to help with rolling up the tent and everything and working with the big animals, elephants and whatnot. But after the tent went down, I went out and took the flags off the top of the tent and rolled them up, and I got to carry, you know, that was it. And then at the end of the evening, that we all lined up for the circus wagon, and everybody got $2 for working all evening. I got the same as all the rest of the guys. The funny follow-up story to that is just when I was in college, you know, 20 years later or whatever, 15 years later, that I had the circus came to town again, and I saw it, and they asked again, we want to know if anybody wants to come. And it said, yeah. So this time I was, you know, sweating and working, you know, one of the guys, and lined up, $2. Still got two.
Exactly. <You know? laughs> And this time you worked harder.
Harder.
I should have done the flags again.
That was my first job as a circus.
Oh, man, that's so cool. Well, you know, I mean, now being a part of circus, I realize what a special entity it is, and how it really is. I mean, there's nothing else like it. And until you do it, you don't know. I can only explain it, and people can can try and experience it. But unless you've done it, I mean, unless you've done circus,
I can't imagine
you
that.
Can't. Yeah.
When you're talking about, you know, last evening that you had average audience of 6,000 to 8,000 people. I mean, amazing.
Yeah.
To me.
I mean, I mean, basically they asked me to be a part of Ringling Brothers Circus. And as time went on, when I was signed and ready to go again, they kind of realized, they go, oh, well, I bet you can do double duties. You can be the star of the show. Cause typically in a circus, as you know, you have the star, whether it's an animal act, whether it's a clown, whether it's whatever the case may be, you have your star act.
That's right.
And then you have
used to be the guy who was the lion tamer.
Gunther Gabriel Williams.
Gunther
Gabriel Williams was one of the biggest stars in Ringling Brothers history.
Yeah.
And so he was a star, and then you have the ringmaster, who is the MC and host.
Right.
Well, they knew they wanted me to be the star of the show, but then they said, well, you could do double duties and also be the ringmaster. So I was doing two spots, which I was really happy about. And we went on this journey to create this magic themed circus. Again, Jim Steinmeier was
the creating consultant and the builder of the illusions and all that.
Yep. He
did you work with him in consulting when you had these ideas, or
there was definitely a process where I pitched ideas, and some ideas obviously did make the show, some of them did not. I mean, that's kind of how these production shows work.
Yeah.
But I was a part of that, and I would talk to Jim about ideas, and the director, Shonda Sawyer, who's a great director. She has such a great vision, and she did a fantastic job on Zing Zang Zoom. And so this is where Jim and I's relationship blossomed, is on Ringling. I knew him, and I had that introduction with him on Disney, and then come Ringling Brothers. This is when our relationship really, really blossomed. So basically we're getting ready to go, and I have to take a little, sidestep here, because my sister was always the performer of the family. So my older sister, Leah, she was always the one. She was in gymnastics and a dancer. She was a cheerleader for the NFL, for 3 years, for the Raiders. Mm-hmm. And then she got into, while I was on tour with Disney, into circus performing, and she started doing these, like one-offs and corporate gigs and things like this, doing trapeze. And I was a few months out from Ringling Brothers, from opening, and I said to Leah, like, one day we're talking about it, and I go, why don't you do Ringling with me? And she goes, oh my gosh, that'd be so fun. So what ended up happening is she sent a videotape to Tim Holst, at the time was the talent coordinator for Ringling Brothers, And she and I toured together for the first year of Ringling Brothers. And she was a production woman, and I was obviously the ringmaster. And but yeah, so during this year, I was still on tour with Disney. So I was doing emails and conference calls. And when I was on break from tour with Disney overseas, I'd have meetings with the director all the while. This would have been in 2008. And I kind of had said to the Felds that I would like to stay on Disney until I'm absolutely needed in for rehearsals for the circus.
Circus, right.
So I left Disney. And 2 weeks later, I had a report for rehearsals. I left tour in Disney in Spain, and I was home, packed all my stuff, shipped it to Florida, to Tampa, where rehearsals would take place. And then I flew over there, and that's when rehearsals began. But I was also there, for, you know, during the white model meeting for Ringling Brothers Circus.
Wait, and white model meeting?
The white model meeting for any production show is basically when the creative team gets together and they present, and the director presents to the producers and, you know, to the Feld Entertainment Company, the builders and the costume designers and the scenic designers, all the people that are in-house, they present the show for the very first time. And they use little scaled models, and they have them built out of like foam board and little plastic.
Yeah, like an architect.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I was there, and it was a blast. And this is when I really – it was really funny. Like I was sitting next to Nicole – you know, Feld and Kenneth in this meeting, and they're, you know, and Shonda's referring, Alex is then going to say this. And I'm like, but I'm Alex. Like, what?
I'm right here.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to say what?
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to do what? Am I going to do? I mean, all the while, of course, I pitched ideas, and some of the ideas and the illusions in the show that I had pitched to Shonda and Jim made it in, which is really cool. But it was funny because after the show, after the white model meeting was done and finished, Kenneth came up to me and he said, he goes, you know, I've seen a lot of people try and be a ringmaster. And he said that nobody gets it until they do it. Mm-hmm. And it's harder than what everybody thinks. And he said, we're counting on your energy, Alex. And if you don't have energy in the show.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, he goes, if you don't have energy in the show, the show's not going to work.
Yeah.
He goes,
It all depends on you.
If you have the energy, the show's going to be great. If you don't have it, it's not going to be a good show. And he says, but no one gets it unless they do it. And he goes, I could talk to you about it, but I've never done it. Once you get in that ring and you have to command the attention in the round of thousands of people.
Yeah.
And he also said to me, I mean, Kenneth, first of all, is one of the smartest men I've ever met in my life. And Kenneth knows more about magic than most magicians I've ever met. And what makes him, I feel, better than the magicians who do know more magic about than him is he's not a magician. He's a producer.
Right.
And it's very hard when you work with directors and producers to find a director or producer that really understands magic.
It's the other way around. Usually that you're trying to convince them saying, this is not going to work because of the choreography, whatever it
exactly.
is. Yeah, but he understands that.
But
But he worked so closely.
Exactly.
You know, he and his dad, Herb, I guess, for so long with Siegfried and Roy since the beginning, you know, with MGM Grand way back when.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
So he really knows. And he is a smart, smart guy.
Yeah.
And I've learned a lot from him. And I always paid attention. Whenever he talks, you pay attention. Because he's so great. I mean, at what he does. And he's the best.
Yeah.
So, and Nicole and his daughters, who are now, you know,
taking over the family business,
are just as smart and clever.
That's good.
They're just really smart people. And I still talk to Nicole. I just called her up and we chatted on the phone for an hour about a new project I was working on just recently.
Have they got ideas or things they want to do like in the future? In other words, after that was over with Sing Zang Zoom, because that was 2 years?
I did 2 year tour.
Right?
Yeah. So my contract with Ringling was a 2 year tour.
Okay.
A 2 year contract.
And they didn't have like an A and a B or what do they call it, blue and a green or whatever different.
Blue, gold. They have red, blue, and gold. Red typically was the larger show. Mine was red, and then blue. Red and blue are the big shows. They play in major markets. The gold show plays smaller markets. It's about a third or fourth of the size.
Okay.
The red and blue shows are original shows. Everything's created original for those. Typically, the gold will be pieces of the old red and blue.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to explain, but I mean, I was on the big show. I mean, we had, it was really great. And I lived on the circus train. The gold show doesn't travel by train. Red and blue do.
I was going to say, as far as the train goes, you know, when I went to visit Larry and Clark and in his suite, if you will,
you know,
he had a little, even though that he was like the lead clown, and he was saying, well, you, there's a pecking order as to the different size. And he said, you know, there is Alex's place. He's got a big one. So, compared to everybody else, you
had
a big one.
Yeah, I had, I mean, my.
You had a whole car, didn't you?
Yeah, mine was just about a half. They don't have full cars anymore.
Okay.
The largest train car you could get is about a half a car. And mine was about a half a car.
Mm-hmm.
Mine was, you know, basically was, but I mean, right. It was a little bit less. And I was on a private car. So normally you have your community cars and your private cars. A community car has a hall that traverses the entire length of this train car. Yeah. And that way you can move from, you know, you have multiple people living on one train car, maybe 16 people might live on train car, maybe more.
Because the train just pull up over to the side of the track, and they just park there for as long as that the circus is in town. Then they just kind of move on down to the next.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So my train car was it was one of the nicest on the train. I had a full kitchen with a full size fridge and stuff, and a stove and oven.
Any interesting stories about?
I loved it.
Tell me something.
Okay. You know what? I mean. The circus, if you ask most circus performers who have done Ringling, say, what's your favorite part of Ringling?
Uh-huh.
They'll say the train.
Oh.
And not even the show. Hmm. They'll say the train. And it's something about it that just is so cool. And again, I can describe it, but you really won't understand unless you do it. And when you talk to circus performers, man, you tell them, train. Oh, love the train. Hmm. It's really one of the best parts.
I guess it's kind of because you're actually living in such close proximity with each other.
Well,
you become family more.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It is a family. Mm-hmm. And, so Ringling Brothers, my show, we traveled with about 300 people. Mm-hmm. The train was fully connected, was over a mile long. We had a cast of about 100, maybe a little over 100.
And all your animals were on the same train. It wasn't a circus.
The animals, the only animals that traveled over land, not on the train, were the tigers, because I believe it's against the law to travel tigers on railways. But mm-hmm. the elephants and the horses all traveled on the train. The tigers and the zebras, because zebras are very they freak out real fast.
Okay.
So they went by truck. And then the dogs, the dog acts that, they had their trainers would travel them over land. So they weren't on the
mm-hmm.
train.
Okay.
But the story for the train. I mean, wow. Okay. Here's a funny one. I've never told the story. And the reason why is because this shouldn't have happened.
Okay.
So this was year two on Ringling. And we had a week off break, like a random week off.
Mm-hmm.
And we closed a show in a city, and I don't remember what city it was, but it was a Sunday night, and we booked all flights, and a bunch of people were going home or just going on vacation or whatnot. And I was going to go home to California. And so my flight was Monday morning, but it was like, well, show's over and loadout's done. You're back at the train around 10:30, and it's like, I don't want to go sit in the airport for 7-8 hours.
Sure.
So, and there's no point in getting a hotel room, so I'll just stay on the train mm-hmm. and then go.
Until it's about time to go.
Yeah, until it goes. I mean, the sketchy thing about it is that once loadout is done, the train takes off. But, train doesn't leave usually until 3 or 4 in the morning.
Right.
And I go, okay. And some people went to the airport early, and I was like, you know what, it'll be fine. I'll just stay on the train until it's, and if it's going to move, which I doubt it, I'll just go to the airport and I'll just get off. Well, it was about 11:30 p.m. So it's still pretty early, and I'm like not even packed.
Right.
I have my suitcase open, but that's it. My friend Karen calls me up, and she's like, I'm all packed. I'm ready to go to the airport because we're going to cab together.
Uh-huh.
And she was like a train car down from me, and she said, I'm really tired. I'm afraid that I'm going to fall asleep on the train, and then I'll miss getting off and then be in another city and I can't go home.
Yeah.
She goes, so can I come over and, we talk and that way I say,
come over.
Sure. I said, I'm completely awake.
Yeah.
She's like, okay. So she came over and she goes, you haven't even packed yet. I go, what do I need to pack for? It's only 11:30. It's not even midnight yet.
Yeah.
Like, we don't have to, the train's not going to leave until like 4 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
We know this. We do it every week. Well, wouldn't you know? They finished loadout fast. And Karen went back to her room. And all of a sudden, it was the feeling when, when they connect the trains, because there's the stock cars and the flatbeds that have the trailers on it that house the show.
Okay.
They connect it. They slam the train together. So mm-hmm. the train really goes boom, and it kind of shakes. It's like a little earthquake, it feels like. Well, you can imagine my eyes going wide when I'm sitting there, taking my time, whatever. Boom. And I go, connecting. We're going to go. Boom. And we start moving. And like slowly, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is happening. It was like a movie. There was like things on my table, like my computer and hard drives and like just things. I literally open up my suitcase, take my hand, sweep off the table, all goes in the suitcase, zip the suitcase. I take it and I toss my luggage off the train, off the vestibule. I grab it and I throw it into like bushes because now we've moved. We're moving.
Yeah.
We moved from where, you know, you can get off without there being anything in the way, to now we're in bushes, like into like a forest on this train. I throw my suitcase in there. I grab another one. I'm throwing things. So my neighbor was Tweety's. Tweety was the lead clown on my show. He was he's the antagonist of Zing Zang Zoom, and he was one of my best friends, closest friends on the circus. Was my best friend on the circus, and he was my neighbor. Mm-hmm. He's opening the door, going, "What are you doing?" I go, "I gotta get out of here. I gotta get out of here
now."
And I throw my suitcase off again. The funny reverse side of this is Karen. When she tells her story, she is hanging off her vestibule, yelling at me at my vestibule, yelling as we're moving, "Alex, Alex, what do we do? What do we do?" And she says, "All I see is a suitcase fly off the train." She goes, "Alex."
What?
And then she sees another suitcase fly off the train. So she grabs hers. She throws it off the train.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're not going like 40 or 50 miles an hour yet, but we are moving.
Right.
And basically, I jumped off. Which is a really big no. You do not
a bad idea.
You do not do that into this forest. And then, of course, 10 seconds after I jump off, the train stops. And I was like, oh, my gosh. So now I'm in these bushes trying to find my suitcases.
Of course, yeah.
And the Tweeties are laughing at me. And I'm like, all right, I got to go. Here's my keys. Like, you know, whatever. I'm finding mine. I bump into Karen because she's in the bushes.
Did she jump out also?
She jumped out.
Okay.
And so we find our suitcases. We get back and we take a cab to the airport. And it was just this never happened, by the way. No, I mean, you know, you don't want to say it happened, but it did. But Karen and I still laugh to this day about this. And then, of course, I call the Tweeties. You know, later, and they're like, haven't moved at all. And
you're still in the same place they said move?
Yeah. But so that was a fun story. I mean, there's a lot of fun stories. I mean, it's just a blast, and I loved it. And Ringling Brothers really did, you know, change my opinion, my view on performing as a whole. It really changed my life and my thoughts on show business and being a magician.
And what did capacity?
Well, I guess up until this point, as you heard me say, and even when I was on Disney, I never wanted to be a magician. I never wanted my own show. I was on this ride and this journey, and I was on Disney and Japan and Egypt, and I'd call my dad and go, "Hey, look, I'm in Egypt. I knew a card trick, you know?" And it was funny to me. It's like, how did I get here? And Ringling, when I did get this, and it was a big position, and I was 23 when I opened up Ringling Brothers Circus. I was the very first magician in history. I was one of the youngest ringmasters in history. Mm-hmm. And I was doing a job that no one, like me had ever done before. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, now that I look back at it, I go, wow, I actually, the Felds gave me such a wonderful opportunity and believed in me to trust me enough with this role.
Right.
And I look at it and I took it very seriously. And when I took it seriously, I realized that, hey, look, you know, I had about 25 different, assistance, whether it was having to do with illusions and box boys and people that were contributing. This wasn't just on stage assistance. It was, you're working with other people. It's not like, you know, when you're in a typical magic show, you train one or two girls to be able to do this. You have so many people that you have to be adept at what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You have to rehearse with them. You're rehearsing with all these different people. It's not just you have one lead girl or a second lead girl that does the hard stuff.
You got to really coordinate the
you
whole
really
thing.
Yeah. And I mean, so there was a big responsibility there. And and basically what it did is it put me in a position to be, you know, a star of a production show, and this matured me to become a performer and realize that I go, yeah, I want to do this. This is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. I'm good at it. And I can do this for a living. And that's when I decided on Ringling that, you know what? I am a magician. I'm going to be a magician. I'm going to have my own show. Mm-hmm. And kind of ignited a fire in me, as opposed to before. I was just a little bit more like nonchalant, like, oh, we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
And Ringling changed that for me. And it was wonderful.
Well, when it came to that point, then at the end of the run for the 2 years, and they were going to be going in a different direction than with something, let me back up. When we said earlier that there were different colored groups, I assume that there must have been another magician or a Zing Master for the other.
There wasn't.
It
was just me. And what they ended up doing, like I said, on the Gold Show, is comprised off of the red and blue. Mm-hmm. So I was the star of
the red show.
And so they created a gold show. the Star of the Blues show at the time was, let's see, there was a clown in his second year, which was over the top.
But he wasn't doing a magic
show. No.
That's my point. Okay.
Yeah. No
okay.
magic.
Okay.
But basically, they created another show with a magician, Dave Womack, and he was – it wasn't – here's the best way to describe the differences in the shows. The Gold Show was a magician in a circus. Just like you would see any magician in a circus, he did an illusion, and the circus act came out, and then you have the magician do an act, and then the circus act came out. Mm-hmm. Zing Zang Zoom, my show was a magical circus, and the transitions between the acts were all magic. It was all themed around magic.
Okay.
It was all magical. I mean, I did, you know, a clown to tiger, you know, and then we went into a tiger act. I did a vanishing elephant, and this is all in the round.
Right.
You know, a vanishing elephant in the elephant act. I did an illusion with a dog. I did an illusion with a mini cannon into a human cannonball act. Right. And it just served as transitions. And, you know, I believe that, you know, a show lives and dies by its transitions. If you have good transitions in a show, its show is going to be seamless. When you have bad transitions in a show, it's choppy.
Right.
And it doesn't feel like – it feels all disconnected.
And so
in fact, Teller, when we were in Vegas – we invited Penn and Teller to the show.
Yep.
Penn always comes because Penn went to clown college, mm-hmm. and he always go to the circus. Teller never goes. Teller mm-hmm. never goes to Ringling Brothers Circus.
Interesting.
And Bello, Bello was a star. Bello was a famous,
clown.
Great guy, famous clown, circus
yeah.
clown, one
yeah.
of the most famous clowns in the world. Well, I should rephrase that. He's not a clown. He's a comic daredevil. He would never call himself a clown. So much respect to Bello. And Bello is a good friend of mine that I will talk to and ask him for advice. At the time, Bello called me up and said, hey, I'm inviting Teller to the show. Teller never comes.
Mm-hmm.
And Bello had been on Ringling for years
yeah.
because he never comes to the show because he doesn't like it.
Yeah.
And he says, but I told him, Teller, you have to see the show. It's a magic show. Jim worked on it. Jim Steinmeier worked on it.
Yeah.
Alex Ramon is on it. Da, da, da. Teller came to my show,
wow.
Zing Zang Zoom in Vegas. Afterwards, he came up to me and he just said the sweetest, nice thing. And he said to me, he goes, you know, I don't like circuses. And the reason why he doesn't like circuses, and I understand this, is because he feels like there always is we have to buy time. There is, we have to watch this really fast while we set up for the next act.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's the transitions. They try and do something to say, oh, well, we're setting up for the next real act, but watch this in between. This isn't really part of the show, but it's something that we have to buy time with.
Yeah.
And I understand what he's saying exactly when he says that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit of truth to that. And Teller said, in Zing Zang Zoom, I never felt like my time was being wasted.
It was seamless.
I felt that all the transitions between these circus acts could live on their own. And the truth was, because they could. Because it was me presenting a magic act, and it was me presenting an act that fed the story of the show, fed the plot.
So it's almost as if that your magic act was interrupted by the circus.
Yeah. No, well, you know what it was? It was a magic-themed circus where I was, in my mind, my internal, you know, monologue is, I'm allowing you to be a part of my world.
Uh-huh.
And then Tweety's character was named Mr. Gravity, the lead clown and the antagonist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was trying to bring it down. He was trying to disrupt
right.
the circus. And basically, you know, in the end, we want to become friends. And there's that whole resolution that's
mm-hmm.
there. And that's why it served well. And like I said, you know, I did an illusion with a mini cannon, and we did a vanish, you know, with a mini cannon.
And the dog.
Girl vanished.
Yep.
And then she did a high fall into the human cannonball act. It was a natural transition,
mm-hmm.
natural.
Yep.
And with a tiger, you know, Tweety was in the cage, and then I transformed him into a tiger.
Mm-hmm.
One, that's a wonderful illusion, wonderful magic the audience
right.
gets to experience. But what better way to follow it with than a tiger act with 12 tigers in a cage.
Right.
I mean, it's almost like the first time that trick actually made sense.
Right.
You know,
right.
you have an elephant parade come out with 11 elephants circling around, and then I make one of them
disappear.
Vanish.
Yeah.
It all fit naturally
mm-hmm.
and organically. And
mm-hmm.
and Shauna did a great job of writing the show and her creative team and Jim and I and Jim designing the illusions to make it work. And that's what I think was the value.
And that's what Teller was saying, that he
– Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's opposed to other circuses when they have a magic act in it, even if it's a quote-unquote magic theme,
yeah.
it's more of a magician in a circus, and he does a magic act, and then you have the circus act, and then another magic act, and then another circus act.
Yeah.
And Zing Zing Zoom was not that.
Right.
It was a magic thing. It was a magical circus.
You said you didn't watch a lot of magic shows or any, I guess, you know, growing up then as well. But there's the difference, like, for me, in watching David Copperfield and Doug Henning. Because Doug Henning, both being great magicians in their own right, Doug Henning would do one disjointed trick after another. It's like, here's a trick, whoa, isn't that great? Here's another trick, whoa. Whereas Copperfield seemed to have a theme, and there was magic happening within that vignette.
Right.
And so it was logical, you know.
Absolutely.
I should
then now say, on tour with Ringling, and Disney too, but Ringling primarily, is, like I said, my opinion changed. And then, you know, now I have seen Copperfield specials and Doug Henning specials, and I study, you know, the masters. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to be the best, you have to study the best.
You have to know what
they're doing. And David Copperfield is the best. And he, hats off to him. And every time I go to Vegas, I go and I buy a ticket and I sit front row and I just watch and study and pay attention, because, you know, he has done more shows than most people will ever do in their lifetime.
Right.
And you know, so I much respect to that man.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you study them and you learn, you know, why it works. And I also study not just, and you know, the funny thing is that I don't consider myself a comedian by any means. I don't do comedy magic, but, you saw my show, my current show last night, and you said something funny that, yeah, oh man, the show's so funny. And people, when you look at my reviews, they go, oh, it's hilarious. And I find that funny, because I never would say
it's not scripted to be a comedy act.
So I don't do comedy magic, but people say it is so funny. And I think,
magic,
and what I was going to say
is funny, though.
Yeah, and what I was going to say is I studied Bill Cosby, and I study, you know, Kevin Hart, and I study these comedians, Seinfeld, because I want to recognize and appreciate the timing, their timing and their facial expressions and their tics, what makes things funny.
Right.
And one of the best things in to do in life is laugh. I mean, you have that sense of wonder in magic, but to laugh, I think, is probably even better.
It seems like I heard Divernon, or he was quoted as saying, I believe it was, something about people laugh because that is a reaction that it's a human reaction when they don't know what else to do. Whenever sometimes you're startled, you're scared, you kind of laugh.
Uh-huh.
Also, it's just, wow, that fooled me. It's like, that's funny.
Yeah.
But then when you add a little, you know, some sort of a line or something, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
Well.
I mean, so that's kind of what that the circus was and Ringling was. And I mean, again, it was an amazing experience. I performed, the show itself was about 3 hours long. I performed, we did over 400 shows in 11 months in year one. And I ended up doing over 750 shows in the 2 year tour. And we performed in Madison Square Garden to our, you know, average audiences of 12,000 people a show. We performed the Staples Center in Los Angeles. Again, the biggest arenas in the country.
Right.
I loved every minute of it.
And so this is where I was going with the Fells. So this tour was over after the end of 2 years, and they decided, okay, we've done that, going on to something else in the circus or something else. Did they ask you then to be a ringmaster?
No. I think we both knew. I mean, it was a special type
one-off of thing.
Exactly. I mean, they're never going to do
–
or they wouldn't be smart – put it this way, it wouldn't be smart to do another magic-themed circus. That's what made Zing Zang Zoom, unique.
Sure.
Is because they go, oh, this is a magic-themed circus. Mm-hmm. And that's what made it unique. And if you do that, even 5, 6, 8 years later, it kind of, people will still remember it as that. They may do it another 20 or 25 years.
Yeah.
And maybe sooner. I don't know exactly what. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, you don't want to follow it into another magic-themed circus, because then it's like, oh, it becomes a magic-themed circus.
Right.
But what the Felds did tell me, as they said, you know, Nicole herself said, hey, you know what, Alex, right now we don't have any projects for you. And I said, oh, of course not. Like, I have my own things that I want to do now, too.
Yeah.
And she goes, but when we do, and you're right for it, you're right for it, and you'll be the first call I make.
That's a great,
it's
a great contact to have.
Absolutely.
And
Nicole, I said, whenever I'm in New York, I have lunch with Nicole. Mm-hmm. I still call her on the phone and text her. And again, much respect to the whole Feld family. On the second year of Ringling, I kind of – and here goes back to my relationship with Jim Steinmeier. And I mentioned earlier, Steve Daly was the one who referred me to Disney and really has influenced my career and helped me along the way. And Jim Steinmeier is also just as important and vital asset to me even now. In fact, before we had this meeting, he just called me on my phone and we chatted about a project that we're working on currently. But so Jim, at the end of year one on Ringling, I kind of told Jim, well, I'm done my first year. Mm-hmm. I have some ideas. And Jim, and how do you, and you know, for me, being in my early 20s at the time still, how do I say to Jim Steinmeier, I want to work with you? You know, it's just kind of
everybody does. Yeah.
Of course everybody does. Of course everybody does. But I kind of didn't know how to do it. And again, I'm like, okay, do I have to pay you for this or what? I don't know exactly how to do this. And Jim actually said to me, he says, you know, Alex, I think we need to work on a project together. And I said, okay, great. Yeah, that sounds good to me.
He says it to you.
Yeah. Okay. And so I went down to his house. And
he recognizes that it factor in you.
I mean, yeah. I mean, he's just, yeah, I don't know. I mean, we just really connected well. And on Ringling, we really worked well together. Mm-hmm. And we kind of, you know, now we do. Jim and I work very well together, and we can create some great magic as a team. And so basically he said, I want to work with you. And basically he said to me, tell me what you're interested in. And throughout the next year, I would send him pictures that I liked. I'd send him artwork.
Yeah.
I would text him.
For illusions that you had in mind?
Just anything. Things that interested me. Songs that I liked, okay. Photos. And it's basically what that does is it gets him to know me as a person.
Yeah.
And that's so important when you're trying to develop a show for someone.
Sure.
And why it's so important for Jim is because he's a writer. Because now, and if he writes a script, he can write it for
you.
Me.
Right.
And when I read it, I go, yep, I would say that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's huge. That's
unlike
so vital.
That we were talking about in the beginning earlier when you were talking about
exactly.
going with Disney and they said
and
you're going to wear glasses.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And mm-hmm. that's what makes Jim so well is he can write specifically for people. Jim has his style, of course, like everybody has their style.
Sure.
But Jim can write for – that's why he writes so well for all these magicians, and he does do that. Mm-hmm. So basically Jim and I at the end of this, I told him, we were working on this side project that we're still working on right now. It's a project in the making. But then
can't be discussed
just yet, but you'll actually be interested to, okay. To find out about it.
Okay.
But basically I had said, and I knew I wanted to do my own show now. I said, I'm ready. I want to do my own show. Let's put together a show. And at the time, I had done all these big illusions. I had the experience of doing an illusion show for 5 years now, and I didn't even own anything. They're all Kenneth Feld's owns, all of it,
right.
You know?
Right.
And
someone asked me about that earlier, who owned the illusions for the circus. That's one,
oh,
obviously
Kenneth
Ringling. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, we had probably easily a $250,000 worth of magic illusions and props in that show.
So what happens to all that?
They sit in a warehouse in Florida in Kenneth's warehouse, and maybe one day he'll bring them out to do something for some other reason.
But by that point, I would think that the humidity, particularly in Florida, I don't care.
Well, I mean, he has warehouses of costumes over years and years and years of performances, and
they
sometimes
don't
they'll
anything,
pull.
Huh?
No, sometimes they'll pull. Old costumes for different reasons. Hmm. He has a big warehouse full of all the stuff.
So it's out there. So anyhow, you're talking about
this
new show.
Yeah, so we wanted to put together a show, and I knew that I wanted to do illusions in them, and I would still never consider myself an illusionist, quote unquote. I mm-hmm. wouldn't say I do illusions. I do perform them because I see the value in them. Because when you're putting a show together, if you do a show of card tricks, unless you're billing it specifically as a close-up show with card tricks, people kind of will go, well, you just did card tricks. People want to see the lights and the music and the production and the choreography and the costumes.
Yeah.
So that's what you do. And so basically, I knew getting off the road, I didn't want a gig off the road with Ringling. I didn't want a gig that I was in the business. And what I knew now for the past 5 years is selling tickets.
And you weren't interested in going on cruise ships at that point?
No.
Right.
No. I was interested in selling tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be a part of an event. I didn't want to be hired for a corporate entertainment to gig, and I'm the entertainment at the event. I wanted to be the event.
So there are
you're
so
coming
few
to
venues
see me.
So available in the U.S. to do that.
And you know what Jim said to me, and this is what was so interesting to me is Jim said, if you create your own market, no one can ever take it away from you.
Hmm.
And this is what I mean about my business still, and as we're getting here, still is 100% word of mouth. And so basically what I did is I got off the road, Jim and I put show together, put some material together, which was the blueprint of my current show here in Lake Tahoe. And I rented a theater myself. I produced it all myself.
Mm-hmm.
And the other guy, I should actually say there's a fourth guy, but we'll get to him. The other man who really helped influence me is Jay Alexander. Jay Alexander is one of my best friends. Mm-hmm. And he helps me every step of the way. And he's known me because he's from San Francisco, corporate entertainer, really good, busy all the time.
He works in Houston.
Yep.
Uh-huh. Yep. I know him very well. Yep.
Jay is so busy.
Yep.
I mean, you go out to lunch with him. Agents are calling him on phones to book him all the time. I mean, and he's fantastic. Mm-hmm. One of my closest friends, and he helped me. He designed some posters and artwork for me. A very smart, clever. I can't say enough good things about Jay. I wouldn't be where I am without Jay, Jim, or Steve Daly. Mm-hmm.
This completes part one of my chat with Alex Ramon. Listen for the second part coming up soon.